The gospel we want to look at is John 10, 22 to 30. This is the gospel for the fourth Sunday of Easter, commonly called Good Shepherd Sunday. And if it had been any other Sunday, I would have been tempted to look at the Acts reading. Unlike Dr. Seleska, I enjoy having these readings from Acts during the Easter tide. But you can't pass up a chance to preach on John 10. This section is the last public address that Jesus gives in John's Gospel. His ministry, as you know from the first part, is unfolded in this rather complicated allegory that ties together several images that have to do with shepherding and sheep. And what's so unusual about this particular one is that Jesus himself plays so many roles. Shepherd and door and so on, the sheepfold. One of the challenges in presenting this section of John is the very different image of shepherd that we have today compared with Jesus' original audience. And to help our people understand all that's included in these themes in this chapter, it would not be a bad idea to review some of the great shepherd images in the Old Testament. So the shepherd is not simply a lowly common worker, but is also a royal figure. In fact, in many places is Yahweh himself. Now the setting for the passage we want to look at, in fact, if you already turned to 10 verse 22 of John, you see that it's the time of Ta Enkainia, of the dedication. That's a term for the festival of Hanukkah, which celebrated then the rededication of the temple. If you can see there the idea of making something new again. That's what was being celebrated, and that would have been roughly December, and so we can see the reference to winter fitting in very well with that idea. It was a time of great rejoicing. The festival itself is not really elaborated on, and this is in some ways unusual that there aren't strong connections between what the people are celebrating and then what Jesus decides to talk about. But it is interesting that the setting is a remembrance of God's great deliverance, of renewing his people, and we see a confrontation between his great deliverer, Jesus, and his people over his own Jesus' own identity. Okay. Well, let's get right into the text so we make sure we have plenty of time for that. Egeneta tote ta enkainia en tois Jerusalemois chemon ein. So, egeneta here from ginemai is the common word for a festival was being held or celebrated. It's taking place. Tote giving you the time. So, at that time, the festival of dedication, or Feast of Lights, or Feast of Hanukkah, was taking place in Chemon. Well, first of all, in Jerusalem, Chemon Ein, it being winter, the time of frost and cold. That's the etymological root of the word. Now, you don't see a very precise reference here connecting the times, so you can see a narrative flow through chapter 10, but you have to be careful in suggesting there's a proximity in time here between the first part of the chapter and what's being talked about here. Okay, so Kai periapate ha Jesus ento hiero ente stoatu Solomonas. And Jesus was periapate, walking around. We might simply say kind of strolling, or the idea of walking isn't always stressed, but he was there and wasn't just sitting still, apparently. In the temple, and hieros can include, or hieron can include the whole temple precincts, and the location is given much more specifically here as the stoa, or the porch of Solomon, area in Herod's temple that was dedicated to Solomon's memory. Okay, so that's the introduction. Now the action begins to unfold in verse 24. Ekklozon. You can see the idea of circle there. From kiklao, and o contract verb. Here it's simply the aorist indicative. To encircle someone, surround someone, and here there's a suggestion of hostile intent, of opposition. So they surround him then, un auton, ho iudaioi. The Jews then surround him, and the un here does not have the sense of therefore, and some of the grammars will point out that in its earliest uses, it didn't have that meaning either. So you don't really have to say John is being strange in using un just to connect the action. Given this setting, this is what happens then. You know, keep in mind that John uses Jews in a very special way. Here it's that group in Jerusalem who are the sort of the embodiment of the opposition to Jesus. So it's really not an ethnic or national term here, but speaking of a very specific group. Kai elegon auto, and they began to say to him, or were saying to him, Heos potatim psychein hemon aires. Heos pote, how long? And the rest is a little bit of an unusual idiom here. Aires from Iro. Really means to take something from someone. But to say, how long will you be taking our soul? Doesn't seem to quite make sense here. It's usually translated, how long will you keep us in suspense? As if we're holding our breath to find the answer. But there are other places where the idiom is used in the sense of annoying someone. And probably both ideas are somewhat suggested here. I was thinking of how to translate this, and our current expression, you're killing me, came to mind. Right? It's a very similar kind of dynamic there. This is annoying, and I'm waiting for you to resolve it. When are you going to settle this? So, how long are you going to annoy us or keep us waiting for an answer? Esu e ha Christos, epe hemin parisia. So, if you are the Christ, tell us. Parisia is clearly or plainly. Here, there's probably somewhat of a reference back to things like this Good Shepherd parable or allegory. Stop telling us these things in parables. Just say it straightforward and clearly so we'll know your answer. The condition here is that simple kind of particular condition, or what Wallace calls the first class. One way to sort of paraphrase the force of it is to say, if you are the Christ, and for the sake of argument we'll grant that point, then tell us clearly. So it's not a confession on their part. They think he is the Christ. That's not really a denial either. It's simply, if that's true, as you claim, although if Jesus is claiming that, why are they telling him he's keeping them in suspense? So tell us without any obscurity, without any riddles. Okay, verse 25. Apa krithe autois ha Jesus. Jesus responded from apokrinomai to them. Epon humin kai u pistuete. I did tell you. It's the aorist again. It's not that I'm trying to get this across, but I told you. Kai u pestuete, The contrast of tenses here is interesting. I did tell you, and you remain unbelieving. You are unbelieving. You do not believe. Ta erga ha ego poyo in to onamati tu patrosmu tauta martire peri emu. How did Jesus tell them plainly? The works which he does, poyeo there, in the name of my Father, tauta, these things, these works, martireo, another contract verb, these things give testimony concerning me. So my works speak clearly, you've witnessed them, and still you are not believing in me. Okay. Verse 26, Allah humes u pestuete. Again, picking up on what he had just said, but you do not believe in me. Hoti uch este uch ton probaton ton emon. Because you are not, este, you see the u plural, ek ton probaton ton emon. You are not of my sheep. Ek here is actually paraphrasing the partitive genitive in the sense of you don't belong to this group. You don't belong to the group of my sheep. And it's for that reason I can see that, or can say that you are not believing in me. 27. Ta probata ta emma tes phones mu aku usen. So, who are these sheep of Jesus? Here he defines them. My sheep, tes phones mu aku usen. They hear my voice. And hearing the voice of someone suggests also a relationship of following, obeying, trusting, and so on. Kago ginosko auta. And I myself, that's kai and ego put together, I myself know them. Here also know suggests a personal, intimate relationship. He knows who his own sheep are. Kai akuluthuzen moi, and they follow me. Again, another word that in the New Testament suggests this relationship of trust and obedience. So three characteristics of his sheep. The group of his opponents exhibit none of these. So they don't belong to this group. Now even more importantly, kago didomi autois zoein ionion. So, again, the kai and ego put together. Remember, you don't actually have to have the pronoun there, so it's often used for emphasis. And I myself, I personally give to them life, eternal life without end. Kai ume apolontai eston iona kai uch harpase tis auta ektes keros mu. Okay. Ume with the aorist subjunctive, remember, is the strongest way to state negation in Greek. So they will certainly not. There is no way they will perish eston iona into the ages, that is, forever. And this ume construction suggests that even the idea of such a thing is not to be considered. So it's simply not possible that they will perish. That uch harpase tis, and there is no one, the tis with the uch, then there's not anyone at all, harpase, who will snatch, that is from harpazo, to snatch something out of someone's hand here. Snatch them, auta, that is my sheep, ektes cheras mu, out of my hand. And of course, in this language again, you should recall all sorts of statements about the strong hand of the Lord that saves and delivers and protects. No one can take them from his hand. Now, verse 29 is grammatically and textually the most difficult verse in the whole passage here. If you are simply looking at your Nestle Aland and compare it with your English version, you're probably not going to be able to understand how they got that translation. Let's look at it carefully a little bit. I don't want to go into all the textual details because the meaning, I think, is clear enough, but at least you can see some of the differences. So, ho pater mu, clearly the nominative, so that's going to be a subject, and yet you immediately have this relative clause, but note the relative pronoun, ho, not hos. So this is not my father who does something, but my father, and then this must be an accusative here. Dedoken has given from didomi, the perfect here, so third person singular. So my father, what he has given to me, moi, panton meizon esten. The panton is here genitive of comparison with meizon, is greater than all things. But again, you have a question about the gender of meizon. Now, Nestle Aland, it's neuter. And one of the variants here is to make it masculine. And that's actually the reading that most English versions translate. So it's my father who is greater than all things has given it to me. The way the text stands here, you really have to take it as a somewhat disjointed sentence, with regard to my father, or speaking about my father now, what he has given to me is greater than all things. So the meizon goes back to the ha, and it's the gift of the father to the son that's greater than all things. And then there's a lot of question about what is that gift, what in particular is in view here. But as you continue with the sentence, you see that it's not really the gift that's in view. It's the fact that because the Father can do this, He shows that He is greater than any other force. So again, kai udes dinitai, there is no one able, harpazain, the same verse here, and then the rest is parallel, ek tes keros tu patras, so no one is able to snatch from the hand of the Father. So how the editors come up with the decisions, well, I remember one commentator saying, isn't this the difficult reading, isn't this becoming difficilis to the point of impossibilis? So you don't say the impossible reading is to be preferred. But again, Barrett's commentary on John, for instance, has a fairly detailed discussion of the various readings here and what they mean and how you might try to relate them to one another to suggest which was the original reading that better explains the others. But all that aside, the point of the verse is really in the second half. This is his father. He has granted, whether it's the sheep or the ability to be the shepherd or the one who gives life, he has given this to Jesus. So there is no stopping the Father, just as there is no stopping the Son's ability to guard his sheep. Okay, and then this ends with a very powerful statement that you can immediately see would also have been very offensive. Ego kai ho pater hen esmen. So I and the Father, we are one. So if they wanted it stated parezia, plainly without any parables or any riddles or hints, it's hard to imagine getting it much simpler and plainer than this. A couple of things to notice, and I can point these out borrowing a point Brown makes in his commentary, because this has been a very important passage historically in talking about Trinitarian relationships with regard to the Father and the Son. Brown says, on one extreme you had the Monarchians or the Sabellians, who interpreted the verse to mean we are one, that is one person. So you don't divide God into three persons, there is just one God. On the other extreme, the Arians interpreted this text to mean we agree with each other. We are one with regard to our will or our thinking. Brown quotes Bingle, who is actually following in the tradition of Augustine here, who sums up the Orthodox position that the word are, the esmen, we are, through this word Sabellius is refuted, through the word one or hen, so is Arius. The hen is neuter, it's not masculine, so you can't use it to say we are one person, and the plural in the verb also argues against such a view. But to say we are one is here something more than just we agree with each other. So there Arius, who sees the Son as the first and greatest creature, also can't abide this statement. There is one other difficulty, we have just a couple minutes, and I think it's worth commenting on if you're looking toward preaching on this text. If we go back to verse 26 for a minute, the situation of the non-sheep, the eudaioi here, seems pretty hopeless, doesn't it? You don't believe in me because you're not my sheep. And you're not my sheep because you don't believe in me. Some have suggested that this whole passage points to something that's been called Johannine predestinationism, or simply you're either in or you're out, you really have nothing to do with it. A couple of, I think, good comments to make here are that, first of all, you have to keep in mind what's the situation of the passage. I mean, this is Jesus who is coming to announce that he is bringing salvation. He is proclaiming the word of God so that all can hear it and all can believe. Think, for instance, of why John says he's writing this, so that you might know Jesus and so that you might believe. So Jesus here is not coming to announce that they don't have a part in him. He's not coming to say, I came for these people, but not for you. He's coming to say, this is the only way salvation is possible, by hearing my voice, by believing in me, and that's the very thing you refuse to do. Just as a few chapters earlier, he says, God gave you his word through Moses, but you refuse to find me in there, so you're not going to find life in there either. So all of these good gifts that God is giving you, if you refuse them, you turn away from them, there simply is no hope for life then, not apart from this Jesus, the one in whom God has placed the sheep, or in whose hand God has placed the sheep. So this is, again, a call. It's hard to read it without feeling some of the great tragedy that's involved when people do refuse to hear the voice of the shepherd. But that makes our proclamation of it all the more urgent. One last note, I mean, I'll close with this. In his commentary on the Lutheran Book of Worship, Bodhiker is talking about the propers for this day. I think he says it very well. And he says, this Sunday distills the essence of Easter in a memorable and beloved image. The lamb who was slain is one with the shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. The good shepherd shows the faithful care and self-sacrificing love for his own, which also characterizes the risen Lord. As the fourth gospel presents the picture, when Jesus calls himself the good shepherd, he's making a divine claim. He's appropriating an image that in the Old Testament was applied to God himself. In earlier lectionaries, this text from John 10, not this particular one, but the reading from John 10 came a week earlier. Liturgiologists said there seemed to be no real good reason for that. Apparently it was simply an ancient tradition that had persevered in the church. I think the way the readings are arranged now, you have a very nice transition in your preaching from the announcement of the resurrection itself on Easter through the early appearances of the risen Christ to his own. And then now with this Sunday, we begin to explore what does this mean for the church in every age, that we have a risen Lord who is our good shepherd. So we begin to talk now about some of the implications, the significance of the resurrection for all of us. Okay. Well, thank you all.